That varied depending on what mood Helena was in. But it was always disguised as a playful flirt with another man or woman, a game, a tease, or the next well-publicized charity challenge. I had 8 hours a day at work to imagine what was coming my way when I arrived home. It could be pleasure, it could be pain, or it could be both. Are you beginning to understand how my life was changing? And yet you still married her. Are you mad? Of course I married her. My life with Helena was the best thing imaginable. Paradise. I was obsessed with her. Every waking moment at work and every night, even in my sleep. I couldn't wait to marry her before she tired of me or I failed to please her. In the same way that she wanted me, I had to own her and possess her. Wasn't there one niggling doubt? I had no reservations left. She adored Josh, and he adored her, and the wedding was to be perfect. Fucking perfect. We had to look flawless for the day, for the photos, and for our public face of marital harmony and generosity to charity, and you know what? We looked sensational. There was a raw edge to Matthew's voice, and a creeping anger rising to the surface. Conrad took a chance and pushed for more of a reaction.
Did you pass the test on your wedding day? Did you behave like a good boy, or did you incur a penalty?
Matthew sneered. I'm not a child, Mr. Neil. I wasn't her pet or a plaything. This was a serious relationship built on mutual trust. If Helena thought that she couldn't trust me, then she would react. Once that was made clear to me, it was not hard to remain within the parameters. However, Helena was not the sort of person to be satisfied with the status quo. She would become bored without a threat or a challenge, and that's how I kept her interested in me. Do you see?
Conrad shook his head. No, I'm sorry. I don't see. What you describe is a game being played by two people who receive equal amounts of pleasure from the relationship.
It was to begin with. But as I have just said, Helena would have been bored if our marriage had maintained the same routines. The special challenges for charity and her personal surprises provided her with a way of testing me, even after we were married. It kept the excitement alive.
Chapter 6. Conrad held a cab at the station and sat back, resting his head for a few precious minutes, before putting on a brave face and greeting Delia with a bunch of expensive flowers and a loveless kiss when he strolled through their front door.
God, I hate this bloody house, with its white walls and shining surfaces. It's unforgiving, empty of character, like Delia.
Hello, darling. How long till you can be ready?
Delia asked, bustling in her crispy dress as she hung her husband's jacket up inside the sliding doors of the cloakroom. No shoes or coats, tennis rackets or umbrellas were permitted to be seen on display in Delia's house, and neither was dust nor a cushion out of place.
Ready? Ready for what?
Please say you haven't forgotten. We've promised to go to Pippa's book launch for Nibbles and Wine. We must be seen to be supporting her cause.
Must we? I can't stand Pippa and her simpering entourage. Bunch of morons, the lot of them. Give me strength.
What did you say, darling?
Delia asked, and for a brief second he thought he had accidentally spoken out loud.
Nothing.
What do you mean, nothing? When are you going to be ready?
Delia swished past him again on a mission to put the flowers in water and to find her clutch bag.
I'm not...
Not what?
I'm not going to be ready because I'm not going. For a change, real life is beckoning me in the shape of a pint of beer in the pub, not a cocktail or a glass of Prosecco with false people in a pretend world. Delia, I've had it with launch parties and loveys getting married. Enough! Do you hear me?
Delia teetered back across the hall in her high heels and smiled.
"I'm sorry, darling. I missed all that. What did you say?"
"I can't go. I'm shattered and I fancy a drink in the pub. Delia, forgive me just this once, please."
The smile on Delia's face slipped away to be replaced by a scowl.
"Do as you bloody well like, Con. I'm trying to do my best to support your career, and you throw it back in my face. If that's your decision, then I'll represent us both. In style. And I'll do it willingly. Money?"
She held out the palm of her hand expectantly, onto which her husband placed a layer of mixed notes. She nodded when she thought he had handed over enough for her needs that evening. With her hair sprayed solidly in place and makeup checked, she left, taking his shining clean white Range Rover, ignoring her Mini alongside it in the garage, and roared out of the drive to make her feelings known. He couldn't believe his luck. The sense of freedom he felt as he walked into the Valiant Soldier only served to remind him of the life he had wanted to lead with Lorna. He should have been walking along, going for a pint, holding her hand. But he wasn't, and it was his own stupid fault. He had been checking his phone all afternoon in the agonizing hope that she would reply by asking to see him immediately. Nothing. Not a word.
"Oi, Dopey, wake up!"
A familiar voice roused Conrad from his self-pity.
"Barney Ribble, as I live and breathe, where have you been?"
"I ain't been nowhere, mate. It's you that's been missing. We don't see you no more. She let you out for once, the camp commandant."
"Now then, Barney, that's no way to speak about my lovely wife."
"She ain't lovely, and you know it. She's a prize bitch, and after one thing, mate, your money. Come on, I'll buy you a pint. You must be Barassic if the commandant has let you out. She'll have fleeced you for that."
Barney chuckled and clasped his friend by the elbow, dragging him through the doors of the Valiant Soldier. A cheer went up from the locals in recognition of Conrad's appearance and Barney's announcement that his mate had made a successful bid for a night of freedom. The beers flowed as easily as the conversation, and Conrad wanted to stay in his local pub with his friendly neighbours forever, telling jokes and swearing, being lewd and revolting without having to worry one tiny jot.
"Marvellous. Fucking marvellous. I'm never going home again."
He caught the new barmaid sizing him up. She had a certain glint in her eye, he convinced himself.
"Barney, what do you think? Sarah has the hots for me, wouldn't she say?"
Conrad waggled a finger rather crudely at the well-proportioned lady serving behind the bar.
"No, Con, me old mucker. I would say that is a trick of the beer. She's not that desperate."
"Well, I am. You're out of luck, mate. She's taken. But I do know where you might have some chance of clearing your pipes."
"Really?" "Genevieve's massage parlour. Oh, piss off, Barney. I'll catch a dose at that filthy whorehouse. If it were a classy joint, I'd consider it. But I don't want to have to pay if I don't have to." "No, I thought you already did."
The pair of them chuckled into their beers and chatted amiably into the early hours about women and their own love of things mechanical.
"Good morning, Mr. Neil. How are we today?"
George asked brightly as Conrad made his way towards the lifts.
"Keep it down, George. There's a good chap. I'm a bit delicate."
He was late and had not been brave enough to take off his sunglasses or baseball cap, which were, in his opinion, preventing his throbbing head from physically splitting wide open.
"Don't you worry. I shall rustle you up a cure with my own hands. Always a pleasure, never a chore for you, Mr. Neil."
Pirouetting, George stepped through the office door at the back of the reception desk, shouting over his shoulder,
"You pop along to the editing suite and settle yourself down. I shall be with you pronto tonto."
Roughly an hour later, George received a personal phone call from Conrad Neil, who failed to choose his words with care.
"George, I could kiss you. Whatever was in that hangover cure, I want the recipe. It's a miracle. I feel alive, thank God."
The phone was instantly removed from his ear when a high-pitched squeal erupted from the receiver.
"Oh my God, oh my God! He wants to kiss me! My dreams have come true, Lillian! Thank you, Mr. Neil. Can I expect delivery of my kiss at lunchtime?
A small peck, George, if you're lucky. Conrad hung up while he still had his hearing intact. As he looked up, he caught Annette having another fit of the giggles.
And you, stop laughing. This is a serious situation.
You're not kidding. You sure know how to make a catastrophe out of a cock-up, don't you? From what you've said so far, not only did you stagger home in the early hours blind drunk, but your wife, she of the searing eyeballs, caught you piddling into her best vase. And then you had the gall to fall into her arms calling her Lorna and declaring your undying devotion. Your solicitor will be rubbing his hands together in anticipation. What a plonker!
I know. I'm in the running for Pratt of the Year. It's actually worse than that. I deposited my shoes on the hallway floor and dropped my jacket in the lounge as I headed for her expensive ceramic ware for a piss, all of which is verboten in our house.
I think peeing in a vase is forbidden in most people's homes, to be fair.
Good point well made. I might have got away with all of that if I hadn't woken her up. You see, trying to find my way to bed, I knocked 7 bells out of a full-length mirror thinking it was someone walking through a doorway. Annette let out a series of donkey-braying laughs, splattering the digital equipment with jam donut before the story could be finished. But in my defence, it was dark. That was the crashing noise that woke Delia. Still, at least it was quiet over breakfast this morning. The camp commandant is currently doing her impression of a faulty television set. Picture and no sound. It usually lasts for a good week. I'm not sweating it.
You bloody well should be, Annette warned.
No, the twins are home from uni this weekend, and she'll put on a good show for them. She always does. She'll soon forget about this small misdemeanour when I hand her more cash to buy a present for the returning children. They'll protect me.
That reminds me,
Annette said.
While Slow Joe and Mike aren't in the room, have you heard from Lorna recently? You know she's moved, I take it. The pictures are on Facebook. Did you hear what I just said?
Conrad's heart had plummeted into his expensive boots, and he struggled to find a response.
No, you know I don't do faceache. Delia deals with the social media crap. When did Lorna move, and where's she gone? His voice cracked.
You really didn't know, did you? I'm sorry, Con. I thought she'd have told you.
Annette's face had softened even before she reached out to touch her colleague's hand.
She took a promotional marketing job with BBC Wales. So basically she's gone home. Haven't you two at least stayed in touch?
I sent her a text yesterday, but she hasn't replied yet.
Conrad answered Annette like an automaton, his head spinning with despairing thoughts.
Fucking hell. I've lost her. What do I do now? She's gone back to Wales after all these years. Christ. I can't not see her again.
Chapter 7. He watched himself on the screen, trying to concentrate on the details of his interview technique, and in particular, paying attention to Matthew Hawley's body language. Reliving the interview, working, took Conrad's mind away from the bitterness of losing Lorna, and allowed him to re-enter the fantasy world in his head, where Helena Chorston Hawley had taken up residence. You say your workmates, particularly Gary, wanted to please Helena, so they clearly liked her as a person. You also mentioned that Amy managed a friendly acquaintance with Helena, allowing a smooth transition for Josh between the homes of both his parents at the weekends,
I would imagine.
I mention this because we've accessed the Facebook accounts for you and for Helena, and the posts seem to support the prosecution's assertions that you and Helen were fun-loving, happy, and adventurous as a couple. There was not even a hint of animosity or distance between the two of you. But after your marriage, your friends do occasionally comment on how much you changed as a person. Indeed, the social circles in which you used to move in seem to fade away and become less important. How and why did that happen?
When Matthew stared back, a slight twitch of the mouth occurred only fleetingly,
but enough to alert Conrad to the fact that he had initiated a line of questions that could prove fruitful. Matthew bowed his head, and rubbed the palms of his hands together before replying, again choosing his words with care.
"Yes, the social media aspect of our relationship was carefully managed. Not by me, by Helena, and sometimes by Naomi.
Your research appears to have been more thorough on this aspect, Mr. Neal." Conrad knew that it hadn't. This was pure luck. "Are you confirming that Helena wrote her own, and also wrote your Facebook posts and comments?" There was a significant inflection at the end of that question. Matthew nodded once, slowly and emphatically.
"So, Matthew, you wish for us to believe that the Facebook interactions between you and your friends, your work colleagues, and even between you and Josh, were mostly written by Helena? There is no way of proving that, of course, one way or the other, but it does help your cause to convince us that it's true."
Conrad believed him. His wife Delia did the same thing. Facebook, Twitter, the social media nightmare needed a PR approach if not to prove fatal to his career.
"You are also, therefore, leading us to believe that she somehow steered your social life. Allow me to return to the Facebook evidence. Your honeymoon photos were plastered over it. An adventure to the icy wilds in Scandinavia, followed by beautiful beaches with palm trees in Sri Lanka. For 10 days, wasn't it? A great choice for a late autumn wedding, and filled with thrilling adventures. How dreadful for you to endure. Forgive my sarcasm, and explain to me, if you will, just why your legal counsel insisted in court that this was torturous, Matthew. Because the pictures tell a story of a blissful honeymoon, and so do the Facebook posts."
Matthew sat up straighter in his chair. "Of course they do, Mr. Neal. I have nothing more to lose in life, and I certainly have nothing to gain by lying to you, and my intention is to record the truth for the sake of my son's future. I don't want him to go on believing for the rest of his life that his father killed his stepmother out of a sick and twisted need for revenge or of jealous anger. I have to accept that I killed Helena, but, as I have always insisted, I did not carry out a willful murder."
There was a lengthy pause.
"How can you expect people to believe that your wife's death wasn't willful? You not only killed her, but also disfigured her, and decapitated her as if it were fueled by the most incredible rage. When did things shift from an exciting, adventurous relationship to one that ended in death?"
Matthew Hawley gazed down at his feet for several seconds before he raised his head to look his inquisitor in the eye.
"When Helena and I went on our honeymoon, I was the happiest man on the planet, because we had arranged our two destinations to please each other. Mountains and fjords, lakes and snow excite me. The silence and the clean air are magical, as was the thought of sleigh rides and skidoo experiences. It was great. Of course, I hadn't taken into account Helena's habit of planning surprises for me, as well as the games she loved to play with my mind, and, as it turns out, with my body."
"Go on."
As Conrad watched himself on the screen in the editing suite, he noticed how his breathing had quickened when he encouraged Matthew to tell the story. As he viewed the events in front of him again, he closed his eyes, knowing full well what was about to be revealed. He wanted to listen to the description again, and immerse himself in Matthew's experiences of Helena's game.
"She organized a sauna again, but this time it was by a frozen lake, a short walk from a stunning farmhouse where we spent the night sleeping on fur rugs by an open fire in a log cabin annex. We had supper by candlelight, and a hearty breakfast in the morning provided by the owners. They were lovely, genuine people who couldn't do enough for us, and yet respected our absolute privacy. I can smell the place now. Fresh pine, candle wax, and smoke from the log fire. The sauna was the treat, to help rebuild my faith in sauna doors, I think. Matthew smiled and seemed to be living his recollections as he spoke. The torture was the dip in the frozen lake afterwards.
Body shock?
No, I'm kidding. That was part of the treat. It sounds terrible, but once you're brave enough to try it, you reap the benefits. Very invigorating it is, too. Helena insisted that I had behaved like a coward, by hesitating for too long before working up the courage to take the plunge into the icy black water beneath the thin frozen surface of the lake. On top of that, I had apparently ruined the video she was making of me as I ran gingerly from the sauna to the lake. I waited for her in the icy waters before she made a dash to join me and screamed with shock, just as I had done. Because I'm a man, I was deemed inadequate for having done the same as her, and therefore the video was unusable. She laughed as she explained this, of course, but I was to be punished for behaving like a sissy, as she put it, by being given one of her special massages.
"Please feel free to explain," Conrad encouraged with an open wave of his hands.
"I'll try not to be too explicit, Mr. Neal, but this isn't for the faint-hearted."
Conrad had laughed briefly, under the impression that Matthew was being playful with his humour. He stopped abruptly when Matthew's face indicated otherwise.
"As you will no doubt have guessed, Helena used sex as the enticement and her next treat. After supper, and to allow enough time for our meal to be digested, we sat in front of the warm log fire, nursing a glass or two of red wine. Later, when we were mellow and glowing, she instructed me to close both eyes and lay face up on the heap of fur rugs in our cabin, naked, of course. When I was permitted to open my eyes, she stood over me, feet either side of my pelvis, with a long-rounded icicle held in a leather-gloved hand. She forbade me to move my arms from my sides while she entertained herself with her other hand and the icicle, allowing it to melt inside her. Just enough for drips of freezing water to land on my genitals, making me flinch.
"No moving," she said.
"Torture."
"Not yet, Mr. Neal. You are impatient,"
Matthew chided, raising one eyebrow. Conrad pulled back into his chair, realizing his error, and finding Matthew infuriating.
"He knows this kinky shit is getting to me."
The candle wax was the torture. A step too far. Helena crossed an invisible line that night. She took a large candle from beside the fireplace. Not one of those common, all-garden household candles, no. This was one of sturdier proportions, that developed a crater full of molten wax. She dripped that wax onto my genitals, Mr. Neal, begging me to be a man and not to make a noise. She deliberately and slowly spilt the molten wax and then took the burning pain away by dripping the melting ice from her frozen dildo onto my balls. The finale, Mr. Neal, was my second experience of having my pubic hairs waxed. Helena was thrilled. Not a sound did I make, not a wince or a yelp. And I was rewarded for good behaviour with a sound seeing to, Mr. Neal.
"Very poetic, Matthew. Thank you for taking the trouble to avoid offensive sexual language. Your point is well made, but again, what I'm hearing is the story of a man who has chosen to explore the kinkier side of sexual practices. I'll have to leave it to the viewing public to decide whether that is considered to be torture."
Whew. She could torture me like that any day. "Mr. Neal, not one of those special massage treats made it onto Facebook. Pictures of me completing the skeleton luge, run at over 80 miles per hour, were there. The grueling ice climb and the vertigo-inducing base jump were posted, as were the shots of us during a snow-sprinkled dog sled experience. But never my vomiting with fear beforehand, and never my burnt skin or rope marks. Did your researchers tell you that each one of those extreme winter sports challenges was sponsored? I was even raising money for charity on my honeymoon. How about that?" Conrad spotted again how Matthew counted each of the sponsored challenges on his finger, with a bitter edge to his voice.
"Did Helena count on her fingers like that?"
he asked, struck by how often Matthew would repeat this gesture. "That's an interesting question. Yes, she did, as a matter of fact. She would recap for the press doing the same thing. It irritated me. Strange that I should do the same thing."
Matthew stared down at his hands as if seeking an answer there.
"Is that why you cut off her fingers and toes?"
"I suppose it could be. I don't remember," Matthew said, as his thoughts took him away to a half-forgotten memory. "She used to count on her fingers and say,
'More events than you could count on all your fingers, toes, and then some.'"
"The press loved it."
"Did you have a rest in Sri Lanka?"
"I was hoping to. Helena had organized a retreat."
"A yoga health retreat for relaxation and rejuvenation."
"Doesn't that sound lovely?"
Conrad did not reply.
"When we arrived in the warm sunshine, the yoga and meditation featured heavily in the photos that Helena posted on social media, as did the swimming pool and the beach. Everyone was amazed that we didn't put on weight during our luxury honeymoon."
"You must have exercised it all off, you naughty people,"
was the type of innuendo in comments we received.
"Well, ha bloody ha! I had an enormous appetite and needed every ounce of strength to cope with Helena's honeymoon program. But the word healthy seemed to have been interpreted as starvation rations at our holiday retreat. To top that, and to ensure I was exhausted and detoxified, I had the shit washed out of me several times by a small Asian woman who hooked up a tube from a bucket containing warm, strong, fully caffeinated coffee, while I lay flat on a white ceramic sloping sluice. The noises and the stench were indescribably dreadful. Colonic irrigation was degrading. Utterly degrading. Ever had a tube wedged up your ass while your wife watches, Mr. Neil? No?"
"Look at your face! What a picture!" cried Annette with glee.
"You can cut that shot, most definitely."
Conrad found enough humour left in reserve to accept Annette's ribbing and find himself funny.
"Oh my God, I remember this so well. I didn't know where to put myself. I had this ridiculous cartoon in my head of Delia shrieking at me not to shit on her clean bathroom floor."
"I can't say I have, Matthew, no,"
Conrad replied, grateful for a reprieve from descriptions of sexual acts involving the voluptuous Helena.
"I believe I understand the argument you're putting forward. In which case, can I take you back to the time of your wedding preparations?"
Chapter 8.
In court, a letter was produced, which you say you received before you married Helena, and although not signed, this letter was sent to your place of work and was from Helena's sister. Why was it that Helena never mentioned to you that she had a sister?
Conrad sat back, watching for Matthew's response. There was a long pause, and the muscles in Matthew's cheeks twitched as his jaw clenched.
"I don't know if I have a definitive answer to give you."
Conrad stepped in.
"Perhaps I should expand for the benefit of the people who will watch this film. I have a copy of the letter you received, and I also have a short excerpt from a story written by Helena's sister when she was a young child, also sent to you. Both are very telling. I should let you know that we are making ongoing efforts to trace Helena's sister, just as your defense team did. There are requests for information on social media and via missing persons charitable organizations. We have even scoured CCTV footage from around the Crown Court at the times of your trial, in case she was tempted to make an appearance. She remains elusive."
Matthew was impassive, but his interviewer could sense tension as he sat opposite. He continued,
"This first letter was read out in court, and in brief, It warns you about the potential difficulties you may face if you decide to proceed with the wedding to Helena. This paragraph is particularly interesting. I knew Helena throughout my childhood, but I didn't live with her for many of those years. Her jealousy was so consuming, and her hatred of me so intense, that she couldn't bear to look at me without resorting to vicious assault, either verbally or physically. I did nothing to deserve this other than being born. She hated me from the moment I arrived. Mum and Dad tried to explain to her that there was to be a new baby girl or boy arriving in the family, but she couldn't comprehend what that meant. They said she was too young to understand, but she was old enough to have had their undivided attention for 4 whole years before I arrived on the scene. Helena was furious, outraged and inconsolable. Mum could not leave me in the same room as Helena unattended. I have the scars to prove that. You are aware, Matthew, that Helena had a sister by the name of Tessa.
Call her what you like. I have no clue if that's her real name or not, Matthew said, with an irritated tone Conrad couldn't quite fathom.
You know that Chorston isn't even Helena's real surname, because the court proceedings referred to this fact.
By the look on Matthew's face, Conrad confirmed what he had suspected. There was an awful lot about his own wife that Matthew hadn't known until he was told during his trial.
Her surname was actually Carlton. Tessa says, in her letter, that child psychologists and numerous therapists saw Helena in an effort to get to the bottom of her jealousy. But in the end, it was Tessa Carlton who had to live with her paternal grandparents. The two sisters couldn't go to the same school or be at family events together. It was attempted, but failed, and drove the family apart in the end.
Not the parents, no. According to this letter, they stayed together, meeting Helena's every demand. But Tessa hardly saw them. Helena went to university, moved on, and abandoned her parents, denying their existence. She changed her surname and told everyone she was an only child and that her parents were dead.
They were very much alive until after your wedding, as it happens. Shortly after that, they died due to carbon monoxide poisoning. Their rented flat was in a shocking state of repair, and the ancient gas boiler was deemed the cause of the tragic accident. Odd, isn't it, that Helena had so much, and yet her parents lived in poverty?
He took his time, leading Matthew from the charade that Helena had created and towards the truth.
Now then, Matthew, you had this letter in your possession, which gives fair warning about Helena's potential to harm those close to her. What did you do with that information?
Nothing?
Forthright in his presentation, he had pushed for an overt emotional response.
"Far from it, Mr. Neal," Matthew replied. "The court dismissed the evidence as there was nothing to prove Helena's sister wrote it. It was a typed letter that anyone could have produced. In court, the prosecution asked the jury to believe that I had written the letter myself, after Helena's death, which was an insult to their collective intelligence," Matthew sighed. "Of course, when I read the letter, I had no idea of Tessa's existence, and I was besotted with Helena. What would you have done?"
"I showed it to Helena. Her initial reaction was not extraordinary in the least. She read it several times and declared that I had managed to attract a nutter, a psychopath who was jealous of our relationship, and she even asked me questions about past lovers and girlfriends. We traced one or two on Facebook, but found nothing untoward. So, you see, Helena found a way of convincing me that the letter had been sent because of actions I had taken, not because of her."
Conrad was hitting his stride, knowing he held some information that Matthew wanted. "But those letters continued after you were married, didn't they? Helena was so insistent you had attracted a stalker, she reported this to the police. Why did it have to be a stalker? Couldn't Tessa feasibly have been an envious sister who didn't have the wealth and lifestyle of her older sibling?"
"Yes, quite easily, Mr. Neal. but what Helena and I believed was also plausible. A stalker. A jealous individual who wanted to scare me away from Helena, who herself reacted in the only way she knew how. She protected me from predators and ensured that I would never consider taking the advice in those letters. As far as I was concerned, Helena didn't even have a sister.
Those letters told you that she did, and you could have tried to find out one way or the other. You chose not to. But they weren't just giving you advice or trying to warn you, were they? Tessa appeared to give you evidence. Let me show you a copy of something Tessa sent to you. As a reminder, she sent an extract from some English homework written when she was about 10. It doesn't sound like much at first, but it's so powerful in this context. It reads as follows. The girl with beads in her black hair and with straight teeth was there peering through the window. An older girl with curly golden locks and big blue eyes was hugging her. She was called Helena. And we heard the other girl shouting, "Get me the antiseptic cream!" And Helena said, "Stop crying," sniggering away because Helena was a sour girl. She looks cute and innocent on the outside, but inside she's as sour as a lemon. She had cut her sister with the scissors in her hand, and she smiled when she saw the blood. "You didn't do what I asked you to. No reward for you," Helena said to her little sister. "You did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, but you didn't do 7. Helena counted on her fingers all the scary things her sister had done, because Helena told her to. What does that tell us now, do you think, Matthew? Conrad sat back proudly.
I'm sorry, Mr. Neal. I must have misunderstood the significance of that reference. When I was sent that by the lady you called Tessa, who is apparently Helena's sister, it was another piece of evidence to strengthen our hypothesis that a stalker was hounding me. Anyone could have picked up on the habit Helena had of counting on her fingers. It sounds the same as it did then. Coincidental.
He's right, you know, Annette said, stretching her arms up in the air and thrusting out her enormous overhanging chest. That was a pathetic story, which anyone could have written pretending to be a child. It could have been about our Helena or any other Helena. But we may keep it in, given that we don't have any footage from an interview with Tessa, because she may not exist. I was thinking, you know, he talks about putting in a clip or two of the videos showing Matthew and his extreme challenges. I think we should. That poor man has flown, bounced, and teetered on tightropes for 2 years without getting seriously injured or dead. It's hard to believe, really, after all that effort, success, money raised for other people, notoriety and adulation, that he turns out to be a psycho slasher.
I thought we'd identified the videos on his Facebook as being too staged, too perfect to bother with.
Yes, we did, which is why I set Joe here a task to find other sources. Can you do some homework on the ones he found, Conrad? I can't give the job to Mike. He doesn't know what to look for, but you do. And if they're of good enough quality, we may be able to get a close-up headshot when Matthew's in action. Let's see if we can find evidence of the fear of heights he talks about, or the rope burns. Slow Joe has put the clips on a hard drive for you, and he's trawled YouTube, other posts on Facebook, and the rest of the internet to find a selection of the best.
Annette leant across to whisper in her colleague's ear.
He's not a bad lad, really.
Evidently, Slow Joe was making progress, and Conrad was pleased for him. But it was the junior editor, Mike, he felt sorry for. Annette never allowed him to take responsibility for anything, unless it was under her strict guidance. He was a wizard with the equipment, and it was strongly suspected that Annette was trying to delay Mike's career advancement. She clearly wanted him by her side to make up for her lack of technical ability when it came to innovations in the digital world, and Mike was too nice to see it. However, on this occasion, Conrad latched onto the fact that Annette was not undermining faithful lapdog Mike. Keeping Conrad's mind away from Lorna by setting work he could do at home would help to avoid the inevitable conflict with Delia. Annette was trying to do him a favour. hiding away in my little office, playing with video clips of a cold-blooded killer enjoying himself, just to avoid having to be around my wife. Is that what my married life has come to? Is this a taste of my future?
Coffee break, children. Your turn to make a mad dash for the bargains at Poncho's, please.
Annette was talking to Mike and Joe, who willingly took up their challenge and a chance for time away from the confines and intensity of watching the endless screening. Conrad stood up to alleviate the numbness in his behind and to stretch, synchronizing with Annette, who was doing the same from a seated position.
Shit, that's reminded me. I need to phone the kids to see if they're catching the train from Bangor tomorrow and how long they're staying for. If they're back for a week or more, I might have to collect them.
He paused. His arms dropped limply by his side.
Bloody hell, I hope not. Delia might want to come along. Can you imagine how that journey would pan out? Hours of silent bitterness followed by a return journey the next day, filled with plastic pretense and false laughter. Pukesville.
Annette gave a sympathetic glance.
Why don't you go to collect them tomorrow? We'll carry on here. You can always put Delia off the idea of spending 2 days with you by placing sex firmly on the agenda. Tell her your drunken exploits were caused by testosterone overload, and that a night in a cheap hotel being filthy will cure you.
Annette, sometimes I think you're wasted in this business. Agony aunts earn a lot of money working in the glossy magazine sector. You're a relationship genius.
I know. While you're in Bangor, you can stay at the management centre at the university. They have beautiful bed and breakfast accommodation on site, and it's within walking distance of a great pub and BBC Wales. You could look Lorna up while you're there. She's working on site. I checked.
Conrad was still for a while.
She's in Bangor, but I thought she was based in Cardiff.
Annette pleaded with him.
Con, you're a good mate, and I can't take the heartache I see in you much longer. Your mind is all over the place, and you've been acting like a lost puppy since we finished filming the first series. You're an idiot. The truth behind the lies became a sensation, and suddenly your wife goes into overdrive to sell you for more money and blackmails you into saving your washed-up marriage. Money, not love, is what she wanted. You don't need to spend the rest of your life with a dried-up cold fish like her. Grow some balls, for fuck's sake. Life's too short.
Conrad was momentarily stunned into silence, and there was an uncomfortable pause before he simply held Annette's rounded face in his hands and kissed her full on the mouth.
Why didn't you say this 3 months ago?
He turned as if to leave the room, but Annette had to call him back. She took a minute to recover from the unusual show of personal affection, despite knowing there was no romantic connotation to Conrad's kiss. It was one of friendship and gratitude. But even so, it had taken her by surprise. Desperate for a trip to the ladies' toilet, she had tried to stand, but her thighs had taken up the available space beneath the arms of her swivel chair and overspilled the seat to such an extent that she found herself moulded into it. It took a gargantuan effort on her friend's part to help prise her free.
Thanks, Con. I know. I should see if the doctors can review my thyroid function.
Conrad was left alone in the editing suite, allowing him privacy while he checked his phone for messages again. Nothing. Disappointed, he diverted his attention away from his mobile and picked up the registered letter that Lillian had given him after lunch the previous day. He'd thrown it on top of a pile of correspondence that he was hoping would miraculously deal with itself. Reading the words in front of him, it dawned that the team's search for Tessa had taken a dramatic step forward.
Dear Mr. Neal and colleagues, please do not persist in trying to identify me. I understand your wish to interview me for your documentary, and I'm informed that you are busy editing the final product as I write, but I don't want to be found. Forget the postmark. I don't live there. Helena is dead, and for that I am profoundly grateful to Matthew, because I can now be free, but only if you leave me alone. My expectation is that you will announce on social media that you are no longer seeking me out. You don't need me. You have what you need from Matthew. Kind regards.
The letter was dated, but not signed.
Conrad did not need a signature to identify the author. As far as he was concerned, it had to be Tessa, and far from having any intention of withdrawing the search for Helena's sister, he was determined to redouble the efforts. "Who has access to the Truth Behind the Lies Twitter page and Facebook?" he asked Mike when he returned cheese twists in one hand, coffees in the other. "There's a whole department for that upstairs. I'll give them a ring for you." A new useful contact was made. Raj, who was extremely helpful in allowing Conrad to explain his intentions and in getting a strong message across to Tessa on social media. "Raj, you're a star. That should hook her in. Enticing words and a video clip. Lovely. A short personal filmed appeal for information. That has to be one of the best ideas anyone has come up with so far. Nice doing business with you. Be in touch again soon." Chapter 9. The house was warm, but the reception received when he walked in was decidedly frosty. Delia was not expecting an expensive gift from Conrad, and he knew better than to consider such a cheap trick after his drunken antics in the early hours. Besides which, he had resolved to confront his shallow cowardice when it came to his future with Delia, and had put his plans in motion to make an escape from a life of henpecking. "I'm going to Bangor tomorrow to collect Frilizer." Conrad made use of the appalling collective name given to his twin children by their friends. This infuriated Delia and set the tone for the evening. She would accept that he was in no mood to placate her. He had judged this correctly.
"Please don't call our children by that dreadful nickname. They are two individuals. When are we going tomorrow?"
"It'll have to be later in the afternoon. I have a hair appointment at 11.
It was clear that Delia couldn't bear to look at her husband, and she busied herself realigning ornaments on the sideboard in the lounge. "You're not coming with me. I've arranged with Freddy to meet him and Eliza before lunch, because they have to change their digs. So I'll be moving boxes and furniture for the day. Stay overnight in a B&B, then bring them back either Saturday or Sunday, depending on how the move goes. I'll let you know."
"What on earth do you mean? How fucking inconsiderate and thoughtless of you to make these arrangements without me. You owe me big time for your disgraceful drunken behaviour last night. You're a bloody disgusting creature urinating in my investment peats. You shattered a mirror. You left clothing all over the floor, and you insulted me by calling me her name. Yes, the whore. Her. Miss Yo-Yo Knickers."
Delia was spitting the words out like a machine gun, and her eyes had become slits from which emerged tiny arrows of hatred.
"If you think I'm ever letting you into my bed again, you've got another thing coming."
Conrad held fast. "While I'm away, you'd better move my stuff into the spare room then, hadn't you?"
"Oh, don't worry. I'll tell the children my snoring had become intolerable and that you need your beauty sleep. They won't believe me, but it'll make you feel so much better. Another charade to convince people what a wonderful marriage we have."
At this, he ducked as a cushion was launched in his direction, followed by another, accompanied by a screeching siren.
"Don't push me any further, Con! I'll take you to the cleaners! I'll have every penny and the car and the house! You know it!"
"I do. Guess what, Delia? You can have it. I hate this house. I want a Land Rover, not a Range Rover. And I'd like to spend the rest of my days with a soft, supple woman who wants to live in the real world. Who laughs at silly things, farts in bed, dances in her bare feet, drinks for the hell of it, and sits on my fat cock because she enjoys it," thought Conrad. But he didn't have the guts to say those words. Instead, his sensible head persuaded him to hold his tongue for the present. "I'll play it your way, Delia. But if you want to keep our public face and our pretense of a cohesive showbiz couple intact, I suggest you reconsider your threats to withdraw conjugal rights. It's the only weapon you have left, and if you remove it from the battlefield, then you lose."
Delia stared at her husband in disbelief. He'd never spoken to her in such cold and calculated terms before. He sensed her uncertainty.
"Right. I'm going upstairs to pack a bag for my trip tomorrow. I take it you won't be following me stripping off your clothes and kneeling before me. so I suggest you trot along to Sainsbury's or Waitrose to buy delicious and expensive food for our offspring to devour when they return with me. As I said, we'll let you know when to expect us home." With that masterstroke, Conrad strode confidently towards the stairs. "And don't organise a stupid party. I hate them. Freddy and Eliza are going to have a barbecue and invite their friends. We shall be upsetting the neighbours with loud music and drunken behaviour on Thursday night. I might invite Barney and a few other real people." "Yes, that's a great idea." Delia looked as if she were figuring out which world she had just landed in. She knew she wasn't in Kansas anymore. He found a suitable holdall and threw it onto the bed, into which he chucked a couple of pairs of underpants. That'll do for starters. Stripping off, he headed for the clinically clean ensuite bathroom, and as he did so, he was whistling. Something he hadn't done for months. His phone buzzed with a message, and he performed an immediate about-face to pick it up, pleading with it to put him out of his agony. "Please be Lorna. Please be Lorna." It wasn't. It was Barney.
"Part two of the plan is in place. You can pick up your new toy this evening. Taxi's sorted. Bring the old one as part exchange. See you at the yard, 8 p.m.
"Cheeky bastard." Conrad smiled and headed back towards the shower, flicking his underpants in the general direction of the laundry basket. Not in the mood to talk to Delia during the rest of the evening, Conrad phoned Barney and they agreed to meet earlier to sort out the new purchase before an alcohol-free supper at the pub, where he would find out how much apologising he had to do and to whom. His recall of the previous night was sketchy.
"There she is, much more sensible than a sodding Range Rover Evoque."
"Cor, you're not kidding. I'm glad to see the back of the bloody thing. It's like a giant posing car for a hairdresser. Useless. This is much more the business." Conrad took a long, admiring look at his new wheels. "Lovely green colour, too. She'll really hate this."
"I don't want to be anywhere nearby when the camp commandant clocks what you've done."
Barney was giving his friend a worried look. "Have faith, old pal. It's worth it to see her squirm with embarrassment in front of all her posh friends. Anyway, I can't see what's wrong with this one. It's a bloody good vehicle. Just the job for moving the kids' belongings around in Wales at the weekend. Right, here are the keys and the documents for the commandant carrier. Get what you can for it. I'll drive this gorgeous green beast home, park up, take the flak, and see you at the pub. No beer this time. I've got to drive tomorrow."
"Just a couple?"
"No, Barney. I'll buy you one, though, for getting this sorted without the commandant finding out. Listen for the explosion. I'll see you in 10 minutes. Delia's radar was working perfectly, and she appeared at the front door as Conrad drove in at the wheel of the used Series 4 Land Rover Discovery in dark metallic green livery. He stepped out and walked towards Delia, putting the keys into his pocket as he did so.
"Whose is that?"
"Mine."
"Where's my car?"
"Yours is in the garage, dear. Where you left it, I expect."
"Not the Mini, the Range Rover. Where is it? In for a service, I suppose, with that idiot Barney who's had the gall to lend you this ugly monstrosity."
Conrad revelled in announcing that he was the proud owner of this lovely, low-mileage Discovery. Delia's furious snobbery came spilling out.
"You can take it back. It's second-hand on a 12-plate, for God's sake. And it's green."
"It's mine, and I like it," Conrad replied as he threw some waterproof clothing and walking boots into the rear of the Land Rover, in case he forgot to pack them later. After which, he left Delia stewing on the doorstep as she sent daggers into the back of his head with her withering stare.
"You out-and-out ass, Conrad Neil! What will people think?"
"I couldn't give a flying fuck." Having avoided a direct hit from Delia, he strolled sedately towards the valiant soldier. But because his phone had beeped at him, he stopped to perch for a while on a low stone wall. Taking his mobile out of his pocket to read what he hoped was Lorna's response, he prayed silently.
"Hello, Con. So, she's finally had enough of you, has she? You want to come creeping back into my life now, just when I thought I'd begun to get over the pain. If you can find me, I listen to what you have to say. If you can't, then it's goodbye. I give you 48 hours. Lorna.
Conrad tilted his head towards the clouded sky and thanked a god he didn't believe in. Then he remembered to thank Annette, and was about to call her as another text came through, which he assumed was an afterthought from Lorna announcing her undying love. It wasn't.
You got my letter, and you chose to ignore it. You will not find me, but I will find you and show you how it feels to have your life ruined.
Good grief, we've rattled Tessa's cage. He checked the phone number on the text. Another different one. Clever. She really doesn't want to be found. His thoughts were brave, but he could only hope that Tessa was making idle threats to keep him away. A bellyful of food and a couple of pints of shandy later, Conrad took a deep breath, walked into his house, and straight upstairs to finish his packing. Laptop. Don't forget the bloody laptop. Locating his wash bag, he made certain that he packed Lorna's favourite aftershave, clean shirts, decent jeans, walking trousers, and more clean underpants. Two pairs might not be enough. He pictured himself and Lorna ripping off each other's clothes in a wild sexual frenzy of reunion, and then he crash-landed back to reality, knowing how unlikely that would be. The house was empty and eerily noiseless, which was unnerving. It was a while before he realized that Delia seemed to be missing. No one was nagging at him. What day is it?
Thursday. Her night for swanning around at the golf club, though neither of us plays. Good. She'll be late.
With the car packed and laptop placed on the hall table to remind him to take it along on his trip to Wales, he phoned Freddy to confirm his plans for the following day.
I should be there late morning, depending on traffic, so I'll see you and Eliza at your place. Got everything packed?
Yes, Dad. Eliza became bossy and fucking irritating, so I let her get on with it. She's so anal. Our stuff is packed, boxed, and labelled. There are hardly any big items, so we'll probably manage the move in a couple of runs. The new place isn't far from the management centre and the best pub in town, which is handy. I'll stand you a pint or two in the evening if you're lucky.
Very magnanimous of you to spend my money on me, son. You'll go far.
See you tomorrow. Love to Mum. Did you mention the barbecue, by the way?
Yes, I did. Brave of me, don't you think?
What did she say?
There were no objections.
Really?
Yes, really. See you tomorrow.
Conrad had trouble sleeping. The bed in the spare room was comfortable enough, but this anxious anticipation about seeing Lorna the next day kept him tossing and turning. He heard Delia come home, slamming doors and clip-clopping across the tiled floors to let him know her foul mood was still very much present.
I really can't find any love left for her. She's turned into a self-centred, bitter and cold cardboard cutout.
Eventually, he drifted off into a restless sleep, dreaming about an escape from Colditz, until he rose well before 6 in the morning to head north and west to Bangor. His alarm didn't wake him. A text message did.
Your wife doesn't think much of you. She and the other Stepford wives had a mammoth bitching session at the golf club last night. Fancy getting drunk and pissing in her best vase, you naughty man. What would your public think? Your wife may have closed her fanny, but she's good at opening her mouth.
He stared at the phone in disbelief.
Tessa?
Could she really be that serious? He read the message again, before deciding to deal with Helena's sister when he returned from Wales. She would have to fester until then. Chapter 10. She set up the camera on a tripod to give the desired angle, and checked the viewfinder to ensure the placement was correct. The record button was pressed. She then stepped towards the tall stool only 3 feet away, turned, sat down, and spoke briefly before rising slowly and stopping the recording. When the short video was replayed to her satisfaction, she grinned to herself. Initially, she had tried to film using a bookshelf as a place to stand the camera, but it was at the wrong height entirely and resulted in her having to hunch her shoulders to remain in the shot. Although at first she had resisted having to unpack the small tripod stand, this setup was much more stable. There was nothing in the out-of-focus background identifying her surroundings. No pictures on the walls, no personal items in the shot. Just her